Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Anne Widdecombe is instantly recognisable. Not only did she have an illustrious career in Parliament where she was a Conservative MP for 23 years and Minister of State for both prisons and employment, but she matched political competence with a colourful charisma that she carried into the world of public media, not least on Strictly Come Dancing, which takes a particular kind of courage. She gave up on Anglicanism in 1993 with the ordination of women, and her high-profile conversion had an immediate impact. Anne, rare amongst politicians, had developed a reputation for straight-talking, truth-resonating commentary. She provided a profound challenge for feminists at the time, for here was a powerful woman of great influence who had left the Anglican Church on principle over its capitulation to feminism. And it constituted a mystery to them as to how integrity, potency, influence and courage articulated and exemplified by women like Anne Widdecombe within traditional Christianity can be so much more effective than the rancorous envy and divisive anger that toxifies so much feminist discourse and dynamics. Since both Anne and I were cheerfully committed Anglicans, each of us for many decades, we looked back to mull over what went so disastrously wrong to diminish a church that had done such profound good for the kingdom of heaven over the years. But lamenting over part of the body of Christ broken by the unremitting ideological assaults of history does not leave us starry-eyed over the successes and failures of Catholicism. If the C of E succumbed to the seductions of relativism and the moral and intellectual anarchy that are its inevitable, decaying flotsam and jetsam, the Catholic Church, with its teaching of absolute ethical values, albeit implemented with grace and compassion, has not stepped into the gap to take the ideological struggle to the enemy. Following centuries of ruthless persecution at the hands of the state, both judicial and cultural, English Catholicism seems to have developed a supine shyness that may reflect a reaction to English historical and class snobbery we can sympathise with, but is unworthy of the Church that indelibly marked our country and history with over 1,000 years of its transformative presence after bringing the faith to it. The sense that now may be the time for Catholicism to claim Our Lady's Dowry and to set out its credentials into the public space as the most convincing Christian church, into the philosophical vacuity that marks the public square, is a conviction that many of the new converts to the faith hold. So we look to our bishops, our politicians, our journalists, our public commentators, our scientists and academics, to step out of the shadows and to own and articulate the Catholic faith with a confidence and urgency born of the crisis of the moment. Anne does herself exactly what she encourages others to do. At the end of our ruminations, we find ourselves returning, as we so often do and should, to the essential issue of free speech. Slipping as we are into the darkness of censorship, we might take and amend the words of Dylan Thomas and use them for ourselves. They were fashioned for the last moments before death, of course, but there's no reason why we shouldn't use them adapted in the last moments before the death of our democracy, and encourage each other as the oxygen is sucked out of public discourse, determining that we will not go gentle into that dark night. Anne Widdecombe joins me now. Anne Widdecombe, thank you so much for joining me today. It's such a delight to talk to you. I've been looking forward to an opportunity to talk to you, and I'm very glad that the Catholic Herald podcast gives a whole range of other people the opportunity to hear what you have to say. I'll ask you a few personal things, because although we suggested an agenda for this, can I reverse what we agreed and ask you, first of all, what it's like to be a Catholic? I'm enormously enjoying having become a Catholic for all kinds of reasons, but you've been at this a bit longer than I have. How was your transition, and how are you finding it now you've done a couple of laps?
Well, of course, it was in 1993 that I became a Catholic, so I've had several decades in which to get used to it. But I think that obviously the final straw for me was the priesting of women. But even without that, I was carrying a huge bundle of straw. The Church of England seemed to me always to be sacrificing faith to fashion and creed to compromise. Still wasn't filling its pews, of course, because that's exactly what people don't want. And I wanted very much a church that took the line that was taken in Veritatis Splendor by John Paul. Now, let me say right away, that came out shortly after I'd become a Catholic, so it wasn't instrumental in my journey, but it summed up why I had become a Catholic, because the thesis of that encyclical is it doesn't matter how popular something is, it can still be wrong. And even if something is profoundly unpopular and widely condemned, it can still be right. And truth is truth. And falsehood is falsehood. And, you know, right is right and wrong is wrong. The Church of England has lost sight of that completely. And it muddles through trying to appeal to everybody. It always was a broad coalition between, if you like, the evangelical wing and the Anglo-Catholic wing. That was fine. A broad coalition is fine. But when you end up saying nothing because you want to say everything to everybody, it just doesn't work. There's no leadership there.
And a few people who tried to provide leadership were always marginalised from the centre as a form of political manipulation. I mean, it's not as if people haven't tried to renew the Church of England. And indeed, in the 18th century, we had Wesley. In the 19th century, we had Newman. The 20th century, there have been some very holy and dedicated people who wanted to do exactly as you say, cling to the absolutes of the faith, Protestant absolutes all the same, but nonetheless absolutism, but failed. One of the questions I'm asking myself at the moment is, was the Church of England as a project always doomed to fail? I had a bishop who's still alive and well, and we came out of one general synod debate, and he sort of metaphorically put his arm around me and said, that's the end of a 500-year-old ecumenical experiment. I didn't think it was true at the time, but I began to see that it was profoundly true. But then I began to wonder whether or not it was inevitable, that perhaps trying to build a state religion as a coalition between different ideological perspectives of Christianity was always a pragmatic, almost Machiavellian move that wasn't going to survive endless pressure. Am I simply reading history retrospectively, or do you think there's an inevitable part of that?
Well, I'm old enough to remember when the Church of England did work, when there was a church in every parish, a priest in every church. You know, there was a respectable congregation, not once, but twice every Sunday. And there were Sunday schools everywhere. And so I can remember that, and it worked. But I think the first rot set in with what we'll both remember, Honest to God, if you remember, the Bishop of Woolwich. And then we had clergymen saying, oh, well, maybe Christ was a homosexual. He was made a bishop sort of 5 minutes later. Then we had the Bishop of Durham, the then Bishop of Durham, actually questioning articles of creed. Now, just stop right there and think about that. You've got the fourth most senior bishop in the Church of England questioning articles of creed, and remaining the fourth most senior bishop in the Church of England. And I think you can actually trace through those times when society itself was going through a massive move towards being permissive and getting rid of some of the old censorship, some of which, by the way, I think was fine. I think it was going in the right direction. But the church took its influence from that. And I think that was the time when the church should have been a rock and said, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is what the church teaches. And it didn't. It didn't have to happen. It didn't have to go that way. I don't think it was intrinsic in the initial plan in the Church of England itself. But it went that way because the Church of England began to follow rather than lead. And it just escalated and escalated, and it reached a point where it was irreversible. Now, if you ask me, do I think the Church of England has a future? I think its future is a very slow. It's not going to be quick. It's just a very slow death.
Yes, I think that's probably true. As it happened, I got to know John Robinson in the last 6 months of his life quite well when he was struggling with cancer. And so I said, look, please presume the excuse my presumption, but I'd very much like to know why you wrote Honest to God. And he was embarrassed, and he said, I'm getting ready to meet Jesus and to be accountable for my life. And I have to say, I wrote it as an experiment, and I was bored in hospital having done my back in. And I had experimental thoughts I wanted to try out. And of course, that's perfectly acceptable for an academic don, but it's not acceptable for a bishop. And I think one of the problems with the Church of England is it failed to make the kind of proper distinctions between the role of episcopacy, remembering also the Bishop of Durham, and John Robinson. But you're quite right. It did the most terrible damage because, I mean, he was the conduit of a whole load of German liberal theology onto the Sunday morning breakfast table. People wouldn't have heard of Tillich and Jung if it hadn't been for Robinson repackaging them in his book. But I thought there were two stages, though. One was the liberalism and the relativism of liberal theology. And I thought that was just when people like the Bishop of Durham showed they hadn't got a grasp of dogma, I thought, well, that's a shame. The church can survive a few flaky apostate bishops. But I thought what the cultural relativism, the cultural wars have done, is to undermine the whole foundation of the church. So we no longer have a few flaky leaders, but we actually have a whole culture which has become toxified by this. And that's why it can't stand. And I think probably, as you quite rightly say, the ordination of women introduced feminism, and feminism was the battering ram that produced the entree for woke culture into the church. And there's been no attempt theologically, intellectually, psychologically to find a riposte to the basic tenets that feminism brings. And that's partly why I think so many other things have flooded in the gap that it created.
I think if you actually look at the progress of woke, there are two very distinct stages. I mean, the initial stage was that everybody said it was moral relativism. They could make up their own minds about, you know, what was right and what was wrong. And everybody except the Pope suddenly became infallible. You know, you've made your own decisions. Well, clearly that is a nonsense. But also we then went to the next and far more dangerous stage of woke, which we're in now, whereby people are telling other people what to think and saying that if they don't think it, then, you know, they've got to be marginalised, they've got to be made into pariahs, they can't operate in normal society. Now, that's very different. And I think the problem with the church was, instead of saying when we went through the initial phase of, well, everybody can make up their own minds, look, this is what the church teaches. There is right and there is wrong, and this is right and that is wrong. But what you do is entirely up to you, because God gives us free will. And if you decide you want to take a different line, well, take a different line. And that is perfectly reasonable. But when you get to the stage of, well, you can't actually be a clergyman in the Church of England unless you believe in the priesting of women, that's completely different. That's now suddenly gone on to another plane. I mean, sometimes they insist on the woke more than they insist on the creed.
They do, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
They do. And I think if we look at the woke agenda, it's just a very straightforward business of the church mirroring society instead of the Church of England leading society, which is what it's meant to do. Now, I don't think it helped that for donkey shits, Catholicism in this country just lived in the closet. You didn't try to make an impact on public life as a Catholic. Indeed, it was seen as a positive disadvantage. And so while you had the Church of England going in 76 different directions at once, you had the Catholic Church united, strong, knowing exactly what it was teaching, but pretty well silent. And I think it took Basil Hume to bring Catholicism into mainstream life in this country, largely because he himself was an establishment figure. And I can vividly remember when I did become a Catholic, that was as late as 1993, being asked on a mainstream television interview, this wasn't any crank interview, on a mainstream television interview, I was asked, how did I feel about joining a religion of Irish navvies and Italian waiters? Now, I was actually asked that. And what that meant was that Catholicism was perceived somehow as foreign. You know, there was this chap in Italy who sort of laid down pronouncements and people would follow that rather than follow the Queen. It was just regarded as foreign. And I think Cardinal Hume, if you like, for want of a better expression, he anglicised it. He said, no, actually, you know, this is mainstream. And for a while, before the child abuse scandal broke and, you know, almost broke the people's image of the church, before that happened, there was a period for a while when Roman Catholicism was regarded as the natural choice of serious Christians in this country. But then, as I say, you know, the devil attacked with child abuse and that faded.
The child abuse scandal has made Catholicism much more inaccessible. I think we know that the abuse, the sexual abuse of children and teenagers has taken place lamentably and reprehensibly in every single organization and of course, including, as critics sometimes point out, the family. One of the things that the way I've dealt with it personally, and this will sound homophobic to some people, but it isn't, is the fact that it seems to me to be not a failure so much of the church and the priesthood as a direct consequence of an enormous influx of gay men into the priesthood in the 20th century. The numbers of people, I forget the numbers now, I should have committed them to memory, but I think it's something like a tenfold increase took place. And of course, child abuse comes in a wide variety of different kinds, but most of the abuse has been the male homosexual abuse on adolescent, pre-adolescent boys. And I see this not as an intrinsic aspect of celibacy, it never was, nor of priests, nor of the church, but actually one of the things that happens when unchecked male sexual appetite of one kind or another enters the church. But it has caused the most dreadful damage in terms of public reputation, but almost, in one sense, almost unfairly, in that I don't think there's any evidence that it was worse in the Catholic Church than in the Scouts or in schools.
Oh, well, I mean, if you actually look, you know, at the figures, I mean, you would be forgiven for thinking that pretty well every priest was a child abuser. But if you actually look at the figures, even after all the scandals in Ireland and all the scandals in America, where they were at the greatest, after that, only about 3% of priests were had allegations against them, let alone actually be charged and convicted. And I think, you know, the sense of proportion went completely out of the window, because it was shocking. One priest abusing one child is shocking enough. You expect a priest to be following the word of God. And I do wonder what these people did when they went into confession.
Absolutely.
You know, did they confess it? And if they did confess it, did they simply think, oh, well, never mind, I'll confess it again next time? What were these people who are supposed to be interpreting the will of God for the rest of the world, what were they doing in their own lives? I mean, it was a complete betrayal, not just of the children, poor little souls, not just of them. It was a complete betrayal of the church by those who were actually supposed to be upholding the church. Complete betrayal.
Yes, I mean, reprehensible, almost without any kind of excuse that one can find at all. But of course, one of the things the media did was then to present it as a particularly Catholic problem.
Yes, they did. And actually, if you look at the facts, you know, there's been plenty of child abuse in the Anglican Church, and as you say, the Scout movement, in children's homes of all places, and of course, in families, which is where most of it takes place, you know, uncles and people like that. And sometimes, sadly, but not rarely, fathers. So it was widespread. It wasn't just confined to the Catholic Church, but the media had its own agenda and tried to portray it as worse in the Catholic Church than anywhere else. And it wasn't, except that it is always shocking when people who are supposed to promote morality and kindness and goodness actually are doing the exact opposite in their own lives. And that I think, was what made it shocking. And I think one of the reasons why the media did concentrate on the Catholic Church wasn't just anti-Catholicism, though I think that was there. It was that, well, here is a church which says it's got absolute truth, which is very disciplined, and lo and behold, this has happened. And I think that you know, there is some cause for saying that makes it extra shocking there. But it certainly didn't make it extra prevalent there. And you see, when people talk about cover-ups, we should remember that in the late 70s and early 80s, the paedophile information exchange, I mean, just consider those words, the paedophile information exchange, was allowed to affiliate itself to the Council for Civil Liberties in this country. And major officers at the time included Harriet Harman, the Council for Civil Liberties, and Patricia Hewitt. Now, do we suppose that they're in favour of child abuse? Of course they aren't. It was the ignorance of the time. They perceived it as an issue of libertarianism and morality rather than as an issue of child protection. It was the times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we've got to accept that it was some while before the nature of child abuse was fully understood. I mean, a bishop might think, well, if he detached a priest from a particular child and sent him somewhere else, that was the answer. As it would be if a priest had got attached to a woman, you would send him somewhere else. But of course, it isn't the answer with child abuse, because the automatic reaction of an abuser is to seek out another victim. So it merely sent the problem elsewhere. It didn't eliminate the problem. And that was ignorance. And it was the 1990s before we had a register of sex offenders in this country, the mid-1990s before we had it. That was the extent of ignorance and failure of understanding. So don't expect, you know, that the church would have been different at a time when it wasn't understood in general.
I'm sure that's right. One has to ask, as you quite rightly asked the question, why was the media so hard on the Catholic Church? One, as you said, because it laid itself open to the charge of hypocrisy. Quite rightly did they attack hypocrisy. But I think the other reason is that there's a sense within the media, within secular society, that the Catholic Church is about the only organization philosophically and ethically committed to absolutes. And therefore, it's really about the only organization left standing which can criticize and offer an alternative view to the runaway relativism that we have. So you described the Church of England as very badly hampered by individual relativistic judgmentalism. Everyone could decide what they thought the faith was, and there was no recourse to authority. But of course, that's also happened in secular terms in society. There is no way of saying to people, here is a view on the balance between slavery and empire, on the balance between sexual freedom and discipline, on the balance between the rights of a woman and the rights of a child. The Catholic Church makes a claim to absolute authority. And I think one of the most exciting things at the moment, potentially, is that if the Catholic Church stepped into this gap and began to say to secular society, there is a different way of handling ethics and human choice, it might make a very serious impact. But at the moment, its leaders don't seem inclined to want to take the fight to the secular enemy. It's as almost as if they're still a bit shell-shocked from the relativism of the latter part of the 20th century.
I think that's partly right. I've been saying for years now, you know, that if Christianity is declining in this country, that is the fault of Christians. You know, and that if the early apostles had as much enthusiasm for spreading the message as we appear to have, you know, we'd all still be worshipping Zeus, because it's up to us. It's up to us to take out the good news. It's up to us to spread the message. It's up to us to stand up for the values of the church. And if we don't do that, we can't reasonably expect that other people are just going to find it. So I think I'd like to hear a lot more from Catholic bishops. They've always got their mitres below the parapets. They always have had. But I think they've got to stick their mitres above the parapets and just say, this is right, that is wrong. You're not compelling anybody to do what you say is right. As I've already observed, God gives free will. But you can nevertheless say, this is right and that is wrong, and stick to it.
And I think there's a very real hunger amongst ordinary people, I think, for something to give their sort of ethical feet traction on the slippery slopes of relativism, because all human beings know that we have a constant array of ethical choices to face. And there's a vacuum of any teaching authority, a vacuum of handholds. And even if you disagree with the handhold, at least you can engage in a conversation with it. And if the Catholic Church would only begin to articulate some of its most profound insights, sure, people would criticize and be cross with it and say, this isn't true and you're being authoritarian. But nonetheless, it would start a conversation that at least we could begin to have, whereas at the moment there's almost no conversation at all. Nobody sticks their head above the parapet, as you say.
I think the other thing is that there's a lack of explanation. I mean, very often people will say that opposition to something like abortion, for example, or assisted dying is religious, and they'll just assume that anybody who isn't religious approves of those things. Well, of course, they don't. And I think all too often, the media particularly will try to drive this distinction, oh, well, there's just a few religious nutcases saying this and there's the rest of the world saying that. And therefore, explanation is important. You don't just say, you know, abortion is wrong. You say care of the most vulnerable life is right. And put that over. And it's actually very difficult for opponents to argue that a child a few days before birth is any different from a child after birth, and yet we've got abortion up to birth in this country. I sometimes feel that religion is regarded as purely assertive without the explanation. So you say, this is right, and then you move on. And what you've got to actually say, this is right because X, Y, Z, W. And I think it helps so much. And I have actually known minds changed just by explaining where the church is coming from and why it holds those views. And when, for example, we had the issue of gay marriage, I was one of those who said, do not make this a matter just for the church. Do not do that. You know, in France, they had a very, very good campaign, purely secular, and it was led by the gay community itself. Plus gay sans mariage was its motto. And I said, what we have to do is not create a division which suggests there's the church on this side and everybody else on the other, but actually have the debate led by the other, with the church's backing.
Yep.
Not church-led, with you hope somebody else's backing. You know, it says in Scripture we must be as wise as serpents. And I don't think we were. We went in with a vast bludgeon and it didn't work at all. So I do feel that occasionally the church should never, ever compromise its views, ever. But I think it shouldn't be afraid sometimes to let others take the initiative. And that can then create a massive questioning, which is useful.
It's very, yeah, that's right. It's very interesting. The way it's happened most vividly now is through the TERFs. So second wave feminists have been the ones who are standing up and saying, in the face of the escalation of so-called gender dysphoria, I say so-called because it's moved from 0.01% of the population to many times that. And therefore, one has to ask if one's dealing not really with gender dysphoria, but some form of displaced psychological anxiety that's expressing itself in that way. But the people who have taken it on are the splendid, articulate second-wave feminists who want to preserve the rights of women from yet a further encroachment of men in disguise. And again, I think it's a very good example of the fact that this is something the church should have been talking about for all kinds of reasons, but lacked the courage, and so second-wave feminists have done it for us. But we should be there behind them, supporting them, saying, you're talking sense. You know, these are common ethics, common values, and although we've been at odds with you for the last 30, 40 years, for other reasons, we now need to make an alliance with you for the sake of truth and sanity.
I mean, I'm sure that's right. If you get somebody like J.K. Rowling, who is not a believer, you take somebody like Germaine Greer, and you think, how on earth have we arrived at a point where, you know, they are supposed to be no-platformed, these big voices for feminism? How on earth can that have happened? And I think the church needs to encourage them, but as you rightly say, stand behind them, let them lead, and that will get more people interested in the arguments.
Can I take you to the Conservative elections for the moment? I'm aware that there are things that you'll want to say in public and other things that you'll want to keep private. So at the time that we're recording this, we're down to the last three or four. Kemi Badenoch was rather exciting in the sense that she seemed to bring a degree of independent, fresh and genuine Conservative thinking. One of the great laments for Conservative voters in the last 30 years is there haven't been many Conservative politicians at the head of the party. They seem to have been essentially indistinguishable from Liberal Democrats in terms of the values they held. Suddenly we had someone who for a moment sounded like a Conservative, and there was the most marvelous, thrilling period when it just appeared that a young, exciting conviction Nigerian woman might bring some sanity back to rescue English politics. Well, that's not going to happen now. Why does it seem that we're going to be reduced to a group of people who essentially sing from the same globalist agenda and don't appear to have a grasp on the primary values of conservatism that Kerry Badenoch showed?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I think that Kemi Badenoch made terrific waves and deservedly so. And I have no doubt whatever that at some stage in the future, she could well be the leader. You know, she could be the next leader but one. And I think would put the fear of God into the opposition, by the way.
Absolutely. Yes, they'd be terrified of her.
Really good. But she didn't quite have the experience, I think, to get through this time. And I'm rather sorry about that, but in the end, you do need people who have held high ministerial office, who know how government works, know how the civil service works. But sadly, I mean, you're right, it's very, very difficult now to overcome this sort of soggy liberalism, which, you know, seems to characterise conservative leaders. Now, I'm actually now, Kemi Badenoch has gone and I expected her to go anyway, I would be backing Liz Truss. But again, you've got this problem that whereas I like pretty well every policy she's announced, she's as wooden can be. You know, she's like, I think I said in my Express column today, if I didn't think I said, I did say in my Express column today, that she's as stiff as a Victorian governess. And she's got to get oomph. She cannot go on the campaign trail with that sort of wooden approach. And if she doesn't get oomph, Rishi will walk it. that's where I am at the moment. But yes, I would like, and I think Liz Truss has put clear blue water between herself and Rishi Sunak, I would like a very clear choice when it comes to the final two between same old, which is represented by Rishi, and new, daring, bold initiative taking, which is represented by Liz Truss. So let's see what happens. But unfortunately, I think Rishi is very, very well placed just because A, he has the experience, B, he has the confidence. He looks like a prime minister. But I think Liz has the better approach, sadly, not the better presentation. Supporters, if she does get into the last two, her supporters have got to really get her to develop a few oratorical skills before she hits the campaign trail.
Yes, yeah, that's quite right. Do you have any compassion for Boris?
Lots. I don't think that Boris was a deliberate serial liar. I think he was serially and seriously chaotic. I mean, I knew Boris, and before he had somebody to run his diary, he just missed appointments all the time. I mean, it wasn't just the odd one here or there. We can all do that all the time, all the time. I had one friend who'd invited him to address a big constituency dinner. Boris said yes, he'd come. On the afternoon, because the friend knew what Boris was like, he rang him up and said, "Are you still coming?" Boris said, "Yes, yes." He met the first train, he met the second train. No, Boris just clean forgotten. Just clean forgotten. He is chaotic. And I think his problem was that he didn't understand that what he really needed in Downing Street was somebody with the grip to say, as Dominic Cummings would have done, "Shut up, Prime Minister. Don't go jumping in with both feet until we've examined the whole history of this." You know, because if you've said anywhere at any time something that contradicts what you're now saying, you're going to be portrayed as a liar. I don't think he was a deliberate liar. I think he was just totally, totally chaotic. And so he would ask, were there parties in Downing Street? He'd be told, "Well, Minister, there were work breaks." "Well, only work breaks, that's all right." So he stands up in the Commons and he says there were no parties in Downing Street. Well, it sounds like a lie. In fact, it was because he had failed to say, "Okay, but were those work breaks strictly within the law?" And he should have stopped and said to the Commons, "I am investigating this matter."
That's true. I mean, I think I've been quite kind to him, but I'd want to be kind to him, but also I might be a bit more critical. But though I'm quite glad that Carrie no longer has a backdoor entrance to her green policies through Downing Street.
Yeah, I agree.
But leaving that to one side, do you think he'll be back? Is there any, I mean, the danger is that he can't come back, you don't think?
No, I don't believe so. I think he will go off. He will make an awful lot of money on the speaking circuit if he remembers to turn up at the right time. He'll make an awful lot of money on the speaking circuit. And I don't think he'll come back, certainly not as Prime Minister. And I don't even think in the cabinet. I think he's had his day. But I think there are all manner of lessons there to be learned. And I am kind to him. I'm not kind to him about his marital disarray. I always have condemned that. But I know the man. And I know the man to be chaotic and to speak before he thinks. And it was just all too easy to take advantage of.
Are there many Catholics in Parliament at the moment? What's the in terms of...
Oh, yeah, there are still a few, and there are some very, very active ones. I mean, for example, Edward Lee, who's been there since before I got in. You know, he's been there a very long time indeed, and is still there. And he always upholds Catholic teaching, always, never fails, and is one of the more outstanding Catholics. There are others there. But there are also, don't let's forget, there are evangelicals in Parliament. And they have the same uncompromising attitude that Catholics do. And I used to find, when I was in Parliament, that when the big moral issues were up for debate, it was Catholics and evangelicals who used to get together. So I think instead of saying how many Catholics are there in Parliament, we should be saying, how many active Christians are there? You know, really active Christians, as opposed to just people who pay lip service to Christianity. And the answer is, there are enough to make a difference if there was the determination there.
That's very exciting. One of the things I've been saying, not that anyone takes much notice, is that it is ludicrous for us to go on looking backwards to a theological dispute that's 500 years old when there are so many important things to draw us together on that we need to present a united front together. Can I just ask you as one final question? The things that might worry you, I mean, some people are extremely anxious about the climate change. Other people are anxious about the growth of wokery and totalitarianism. Is there something that keeps you awake at night or that you pray over particularly that you see as being a serious threat to our way of life that the church should be bringing its best efforts to deal with?
Well, it certainly wouldn't be climate change. I'm not saying that's not important. I've never said that, though I've often been portrayed as saying it. But I do think we've got things out of proportion when Britain contributes 1% of emissions and is talking about reaching net zero by making people get new boilers at huge expense, buy electric cars, etc. To me, that is just completely disproportionate. And I would always plead for a proportionate approach to climate change. But yes, the thing that would keep me awake, if anything kept me awake, nothing ever does. But if anything kept me awake, it would be the sheer totalitarianism of the woke movement. We're actually in a situation now where if you don't uphold state orthodoxy, even in your private website or in private conversations, if you don't uphold the orthodoxy that the woke believe you should, you can actually be penalised. You know, you can be penalised at work. You can find that you're not employable. You can find that tours are cancelled. You can find all sorts of things purely because you haven't signed up to the orthodoxy. And you need look no further back than the Soviet Union to see that it starts with this sort of attitude, that you must think such and such a thing. And the answer is we can all think what we like. We cannot all do as we like because there is a law, thank heavens, but we can think what we like and can make our case. And I always say that the way you knock down an opponent is not to seek to silence him or her, to hear him or her, and then destroy the argument. That is why I've always said, take on a Holocaust denier, take the idiot on, but don't just say silence him, because then you push it underground. And things that are pushed underground can grow all sorts of nasty shoots.
And indeed they do. There are a few people in the church who are beginning to take this seriously. You're one of them. I try and be as well. Can you explain to me how on earth have some of the appalling legislative changes that have given a platform for woke, including the trans agencies who have got into schools and education in the most terrifying way, how has that happened under Conservative government? Why is there no sense of wariness amongst your previous colleagues? And this is not meant to blame you, but do you have the connection still to be able to make representations to people in government saying, look, you've actually lost the plot on this one. Of all governments, of all political parties, you have a responsibility to preserve that which is best, and that which is best is free speech.
Well, of course, plenty within the party do say that. I say it in my weekly column in The Express. I quite often tackle this particular issue. And yes, I say it within the party when I get the chance. Don't forget, I'm now not a member of the Conservative Party, so I don't actually have the access that I used to have. But the answer is the long march through the institutions.
Yeah.
Gradually, this way of thinking has made headway until the people at the top are those who believe it. I mean, when this all first started, I was saying, why is the establishment bowing down to this? Why is it giving way? And now, of course, I realise that it's because the establishment thinks that way. It's at the top of the establishment. It's no longer a question of, well, you know, let's sort of try and appease a portion of public opinion. The establishment believes that. It's actually believed. I mean, heaven help us, but that's where it is.
That National Trust, head teachers, and sadly cabinet ministers is, I mean, right to the top, as you say. It used to be people under 40, then under 50. Now it's gone up to under 60. Is there any hope? Can we save free speech in Europe, in old Christendom?
Well, we can make a jolly good fight for it, and I applaud the efforts of people like Toby Young, you know, who've set up the Free Speech Union, and they fight individual cases, which I think is very important. But something I've just commented on recently, a few weeks ago in May, Franklin Graham, who's the son of Billy Graham, was speaking in Wales, and the First Minister of Wales said he was sorry to see that Graham had a platform in Wales. Now, hang on. He was sorry to see it. And he quoted the reason was because Graham believes, as I believe, as you believe, as actually most people believe, that marriage is between one man and one woman. And that single belief apparently should have disqualified him from spreading the gospel and preaching in Wales. And as I said in my Express column, very good column every Wednesday, by the way, as I said in my Express column, you know, when that sort of intolerance has reached the very top of politics, and this was the first minister, it wasn't just some member of the Welsh Assembly, this was the first minister regretting free speech in Wales. And given that that is what the Catholic Church teaches, would he want to silence all the priests? Would he want to silence all the imams? They believe the same. And it's still the official position of the Church of England. Does he want to silence all the vicars? You know, what's it about? But it's dangerous when it's at the top, and I'm afraid it is now. It's at the top. That's why I don't want to see Penny Mordaunt as Prime Minister.
Well, that's a very good remark to finish on. And it's been so refreshing, and you've been wonderfully forthright and informed, and it's been a personal pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for making the time and making yourself available. And I'm sure lots more people will turn to the Express daily now. Thank you for joining us on the Catholic Herald podcast. God bless you.